from Peace Alliance Winnipeg as well, and we will end with a recipe. So on that note, I would like to welcome Eva Pip, and I will introduce her. Are you there, Eva?
Yes, I am.
Yes, I could see you just a while ago, so I'm glad that everything worked out okay. So this morning, our guest is Eva Pip. She's a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg who has taught courses in water quality, environment and plant science. And Dr. Pip is recently a retired professor who worked at the University of Winnipeg and Manitoba for about 40 years. She has more than 125 publications, including a number of books. She produced numerous reports. She has served on many environmental committees and panels, has been on the board of directors of nonprofit agencies, and has served as an expert witness in environmental legal proceedings across Canada. During her career, Dr. Eva Pip has worked on more than 640 lakes and rivers in North America. Her special research interests are Lake Winnipeg, toxic algae, heavy metals, waterborne diseases, and freshwater mollusks, including zebra mussels. She has contributed numerous TV programs. She was twice on CBC, The Fifth Estate, and she's contributed to film documentaries on environmental issues, particularly mining and intensive livestock operations. She has been an invited keynote speaker at national and international conferences and has given more than 500 media interviews in Canada and the U.S. Dr. Eva Pip has been honored twice with the Clarence Acheson Award for Excellence and Community Service. So today we'll be talking about issues that affect our water and food, and also focus on the contaminants found in the food and water of First Nations people. And welcome to Wooden Spoons, Dr. Pip. You have an amazing, amazing record here.
No, thank you. I'm glad to be here, because one doesn't get many opportunities anymore to speak about these issues. The whole environmental scene seems to have dropped off our political landscape. We're focused on the economy and jobs, and the environment seems to be pushed farther and farther into the background all the time now.
Well, that is a sad commentary. I'm very sorry to hear that, and I guess you would know more about it than me, because, anyway, maybe we could talk about, first of all, it was coincidentally on Saturday, that was November the 2nd, there was a section in the Winnipeg Free Press titled Altitude and Latitude. A lengthy article was written by Julia Simon Rutgers titled The Beautiful and the Damned, referring to dammed rivers, and it focused on the damaging influences of hydroelectric development on northern First Nations people in the territory of the Nelson River. And since 2020, Fox Lake and four neighboring Cree nations, which were York Factory, Shamatawa, Atataskwayak, and War Lake First Nations, have been working together to develop Indigenous-led conservation and Indigenous sovereignty over traditional lands. And this is a huge undertaking that involves consolidating Indigenous relationships and teachings for the protection of nature. Do you want to comment on that, the impact of damming rivers, what impact it has had on Indigenous people, and why it's so important that they can consolidate their powers to react to that?
Yes, actually, this is a very large topic. I've been involved in these issues since the early 1970s, when the hydroelectric industry started to regulate the levels on Lake Winnipeg. But I also have done a great deal of research in northern Manitoba on northern lakes and the Nelson River system, places like Cross Lake. And when hydroelectricity was first touted as an energy source, a supposedly clean energy source, it was embraced, and the development of these dams, especially on the Nelson River system, started to proceed very rapidly. And so we're still in that mindset where we're just always looking for the next dam that we'll be building and the next dam. But as we built those dams, especially in the early days, we really did not pay much attention to the impacts on the environment and on the native people whose land these projects were located on. In fact, at first, there were some communities that were forcibly relocated. They really had not much say, and they were relocated away from their traditional lands because of the flooding. There was very little environmental assessment as to what effects these projects would have in the broader context of the environment. And so now we have learned the hard way that, yes, that the hydroelectricity is cleaner in terms of things like greenhouse gas emissions, but on the other hand, it is not entirely without fault. And a lot of these faults are things that we could have addressed, at least looked at in greater detail and mitigated a bit better than we did. The flooding especially has devastated northern communities. If you look at places like Cross Lake, for example, and one of the issues, of course, has been not just the loss of the actual land because it's underwater, but you flooded whole tracts of forest that all those trees were still left standing in there. You had a lot of organic matter. And under those conditions where you had stagnation and not much oxygen, you converted any mercury that was in inorganic form in the soil. It got converted by bacterial action in the absence of oxygen into methyl mercury, which is extremely toxic. And methyl mercury bioaccumulates up the food chain, and therefore it appeared in all levels of the all trophic levels of the food chain, and especially in the top level carnivores, like things like carnivorous fish such as pickerel. And with each step up in the food chain, the bioaccumulation is many factors greater and greater and greater. So as you go up, you know, first you have the herbivorous animals in the water, and then you have the fish that eat those, and then there are other fish that eat those, and then you have the top level fish that eat those. And so each level inherits all of the mercury from the levels below it. And so in terms of the northern communities, they were in many cases, like for example, again at Cross Lake, they were unable to eat the fish that were right on their doorstep. And even though this was raised as a concern right at the outset, we were assured by the government that, well, okay, so maybe there might be a mercury problem for a couple of years, but that will soon abate, you know, things, the mercury will all settle out and it's not going to be a problem. Well, it is a problem because that mercury, now it's circulating there and circulating, and it's really, you know, keeps getting into organisms. And there are places where, you know, you really can't eat the food that's there, the natural foods. And for the First Nations communities, this has hit them very hard because, as we know, fish are a basic staple in the indigenous diet and also a very important economic source. And so if they couldn't market those fish, then again, you know, they suffered. And so we have these issues with the dams that this was overlooked or minimized and seen as a regional problem, but it's a big problem. I'm sorry? Are you speaking? Oh,
John would like to ask a question, Eva.
Going to ask it like after you're finished talking, so I'll let you finish.
Sorry about that.
Okay, I was talking about the problem. Like as we dam more and more and more, as we build more and more dams, we're also flooding more and more and more land, and this all adds up to a vast amount of land that's basically now useless, and nobody seems to have thought about this. That, you know, like at some point, we're going to have to try to address this issue, and we have no plans to do that.
John?
What's interesting is that, like, I think a lot of people think of hydroelectric power as, like, more the earth-friendly alternative to oil and gas, but I guess it turns out that that's not all perfect as well. But, like, is there better, what would you say are better sources of electricity? Like, is wind power, solar power, do you think we should be investing in that instead of hydroelectric? Or what are your thoughts there?
Okay, right at the outset, I have to say that with our current level of technology, we do not have a perfect energy source yet. Because all the energy sources that we do have pros and cons, and it depends what problem you're trying to address. So yes, things like solar power and wind power and tidal power where it's available, those things do not have the greenhouse gas and climate change impacts that we associate with the burning of fossil fuels. But on the other hand, they have their own other problems. So we know that for wind turbines, right, that there's a problem like where do you locate them? Because you can't have them where you have, you know, inhabited areas where people are living nearby, because that noise is intolerable and it makes people sick. And then you have to look at the hundreds of thousands of birds that die, you know, each year from these wind turbines. Like, in my opinion, some of that could be addressed by having lights on the vanes of the turbines. So at night, you know, so many birds migrate at night, and so they totally don't see the turbines. And so nobody seems to have thought of, you know, these kinds of solutions to help mitigate that. If we're looking at solar power, of course, that is the original, like all life on Earth, right, is powered by solar power. So plants have been able to devise a way to do this without generating negative impacts, but we haven't yet. And so we haven't unlocked the actual secret of how plants are able to split the water molecule into oxygen and hydrogen and convert it into, you know, chemical compounds that contain energy. But we haven't been able to do that actual step yet. If we did, we'd be, you know, billionaires if we could discover how they do that. But now the solar power that we use, it uses toxic metals and, a lot of other metals like lithium, right, for lithium batteries. And so there now you get into this whole range of adverse environmental effects from, first of all, mining that lithium, because mines have very large and long-lasting environmental footprints. And then at the end of the life cycle, you know, all this sheer volume of lithium batteries, they have to be disposed of somehow, right? So some of that can be recycled, but not everything. And so you're building up now this toxic waste stream that you have to put someplace. And as we go more and more towards these kinds of batteries, right, we have to think about what happens to this eventually in the end. And then if we're talking about nuclear power, well, of course, we are familiar with some of the things that have happened with these nuclear reactors around the world, where if you have an accident, then you basically generated a wasteland where nobody can even set foot in it for centuries. You know, uranium like has a half-life of thousands of years.
Yeah, it seems and that so, there's the conundrum of all kind, no matter what you choose, there seems to always be some issues surrounding it, and that's the big challenge. And as you were talking about the flooding, I kept thinking of South Indian Lake, which is a good example of a massive amount of land that was flooded. And I guess what you're saying is all the decaying produces mercury and other contaminants that will go into the food chain, and so it would affect the diets of people that are living there, like Grassy Narrows, for instance. They have to be careful how much fish they eat because of contaminants from the one of the industries that dumps their contaminants into the river. So
yes, because we've had, for example, in the English River Wabagoon system to the east of us, we've had many decades previously of pulp mills that dumped massive, massive amounts of mercury into the environment, and they used it to prevent, because as they generate the pulp, they incubate it in warm conditions to break down the fibers. Well, we're not going to go into that. And so then they have to use a fungicide to kill fungi and bacteria that grow in that warm soup. And then that all just simply got piped into the nearest lake or river, and it spread all through. And so now those systems are contaminated forever, literally. And we do not have the technology how to clean this up. So in terms of the communities that were dependent on fish from these systems, as you say, they can't eat those fish. And also where this was a source of economic of income, because they could also sell the harvest and sell these fish to the broader market, right, even the global market, they can't do that because of that. And so you need to have some sort of, you know, an other compensation to make up for that. But you'll have to do this forever, because we were too stupid and too greedy to think of this problem beforehand, and what were we going to do when this happened? And this is what we're still doing today with all kinds of environmental projects and industry that we are rushing to approve without sitting down and thinking about what the aftermath is going to be. We deny it, and oh, it's going to be somebody else's problem by then. But as long as we can get money now, that's all that's
true.
Important for
yes,
us.
Absolutely.
And this
true.
Is how our society is structured now.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons. I'm here with John Dick, and my name is Mary Jane Eason, and our guest today is Eva Pip. So Eva, there's a lot of concerns about the effects of damming on the waters and effects on the fish. And of course, I think it affects the fish that we eat from Lake Winnipeg and everywhere. I mean, we have to be careful about not over-consuming fish, I would imagine. And maybe we could move on, and maybe you could give us You have also raised concerns about how mining has devastated many northern and eastern lakes in Manitoba, and has also severely impacted First Nations and Métis communities. Do you want to elaborate on that as well?
Yes. But before we just go to this next segment, I just wanted to mention that the fish from Lake Winnipeg itself are still considered to be safe. So Lake Winnipeg itself is not an issue at present. Yes, there is, in all fish you still get some contaminants, but it's not considered to be at problematic levels. I just wanted to clarify that if we're talking about fish from Lake Winnipeg, it's not considered by Health Canada to be an issue.
Okay.
Now, in terms of the mining, yes, we have many, many mines throughout the province that, many have been abandoned. We have a lot of toxic sites that where the company has simply walked away and left us with the mess, and somebody has to deal with this, and unfortunately we are the ones that have to deal with this. And so we really haven't taken this very seriously. Yes, there is a program, the province does have a program to try to clean up a certain small number of sites each year. But as we've seen at some of these sites, even after we've spent millions of dollars on trying to clean it up, we find that often we cannot clean it up to what the previous undisturbed level was. So an example is Bucko Lake in northern Manitoba. There's a Métis community there that has been impacted by that. And so that has been, the attempts have been made to clean that up, but we find that the contamination is still there. And this is an issue like everywhere, because of course, when you dump toxic waste into the environment, it doesn't stay localized just in that one little spot where you put it. Right, you have water moves from place to place, it carries contaminants, and so the zone that's affected spreads and gets wider over time, and therefore your cleanup becomes more and more challenging because of this. And many of those contaminated sites that we have, we've had them for many years now, and we're basically, with the level of technology that we have, we can't really effectively manage them, and so we just basically stay away from them. But the indigenous communities and other communities that live there and depend on that ecosystem for their livelihood, they are the ones affected, but they're not heard because, right, they just simply get trampled in all of this need for jobs and economy and dollars, and that's how our society functions nowadays, that these things just kind of, we turn a blind eye to it, right? We see something that's bad, we politely look away, and many of our success, the successions of political parties that we've had, in government, right? They have, some of them have tried, to do, but the problem is so vast that really, you can't, like what you need to do is you have to address it at the outset before you even approve the project. You have to seriously look at what are all the impacts going to be. And these impacts, if they happen, with certainly a lot of them, it's certain they will happen, like the contamination, what are we going to do about it? What impact is this going to have? And will we be able to fix it? And in many circumstances, the answer is no. You know, with our present ability to, you know, with our technology, you know, especially when we're dealing with polluted water, we don't have the ability to fix it.
And, you know, these mines, my husband, a long time ago, he worked in Flin Flon, and they had mining, well, I forget what mines it was, but the mining has left the town of, like, Flin Flon is a beautiful place, but all the lakes are contaminated. So,
oh, yes, I did. Yes, yeah. I did a lot of work. I did a lot of work in the Flin Flon area, and that mining there are several mines there, and there was also the smelter there, and it basically spread the pollution over many, many, many square kilometers of the surrounding area. And so I spent actually years there sampling the lakes, but also looking at the impact on Flin Flon itself, because in that case, the stack of the smelter, it was located, well, it's not operating anymore now, but it operated since the 1930s, and it was set right in the middle of town, of Flin Flon. And so a lot of that fallout from the smelter, there's a whole long list of metals that were in that fallout. And so a lot of that fell right on town. And one of the studies I did there was looking at garden vegetables that people were trying to grow in Flin Flon. There's very little soil left in the Flin Flon area because the sulfur dioxide from the emissions from the stack was very acidic, basically created sulfuric acid. And so that killed the vegetation, surrounding vegetation. And when the vegetation got killed, there were no roots to hold the soil on the rock. It's Precambrian shield rock. So the soil was very thin to start with. So the soil simply eroded away. And so when you look at Flin Flon now, right, it's all sitting on those bare rocks.
And you would think that it would be a sensible solution, approach, I should say, is that mining companies would have to be responsible for the cleanup of the mess that they make. But instead, that's not the case.
Okay, Mary Jane, now this is where there's a huge, huge, huge disconnect there. Because with the environmental legislation that we have, and especially now, like with these new operations that are coming into being, right? So there is a clause, there are clauses there now that, yes, they have to have a plan for how they're going to, once they're finished, right, taking what they've needed, and there's no more there to take, how they're going to do restoration. So yes, they do have to file these kinds of plans now, but the problem is that in many cases, the company will not do that. And there are several reasons for that. Okay, one reason is the company simply goes bankrupt and no longer exists. And so there's nobody there that you can hold accountable anymore, right, for that problem. You may have the company restructure and, you know, different ownerships, and so original agreements might no longer be valid. And the other problem that we have is monitoring and enforcement, which is extremely, extremely inadequate. Like in most industries, companies are charged with doing their own policing and monitoring, right? And so you can imagine, like, how diligent and truthful they're going to be if they're causing a problem, right? There have been many, many instances of this kind of thing where, you know, spills and things don't even get reported. But what we need is independent enforcement and monitoring. So we do have mining inspectors, but the level of enforcement that they do is often very, very inadequate. Like, for example, in my own experience, I've seen mining inspectors warn companies in advance that they will be coming to do an inspection so that the company has an opportunity to, you know, cosmeticize things and whatever. And that's not how it should be. There should be unannounced visits that can happen at any time so that we know what is really actually happening instead of giving companies, you know, this long, long leash and all these permissions. Now, the reason that we do that is because we want the economic, right, the economic results from these industries, right, because that gives us income and therefore translates into our level of lifestyle and the quality of life. But, you know, so you have this eternal conundrum where, on the one hand, you want to encourage these industries, these companies, to come and locate here and set up here. But on the other hand, you don't want to hobble them too much by having all these regulations that restrict the way they operate. And this happens constantly, all the time, not just with mining industry, but with livestock industry and all kinds of other things, forestry and so on, where you have this balance where you want the development here, but on the other hand, you don't want to discourage them from coming here because of the regulations. And so what has been happening in the last, especially the last couple of decades, is we've been relaxing our regulations a little bit more and a little bit more in order to encourage these companies from outside to come here. And this has led to a general, complete disregard for our environment and our most precious resource, like water, because we seem to think that we have an unlimited supply of it, and what's the big deal, you know, if this or that or that or that gets polluted. Well, if you add up all of the hundreds and hundreds of places where you have this pollution, that adds up to a significant, significant impact and a significant loss of our precious water resources. And when the companies seek approval, right, to start a project someplace, right, no matter what it is, mining or hog barn or whatever, these projects are considered as being by themselves, as though they're hanging in space. They're not considered in the context of all the other things that are already going on in that area that are also having an impact. In other words, we do not consider the cumulative impact that, you know, adding another thing and another thing into a place is going to have. We just consider that, oh, you know, this one, this new mine or this new hog barn, well, you know, how bad can it be? You know, it's going to have just this, you know, this amount of impact. Well, it's going to have this amount of more of impact on what is already happening there. And this is what we do not consider in the system that we have.
Yeah, we have to have, there has to be an evolution of consciousness as to the impacts. People want to have the industry, they want the jobs and so on, but they have to start having a broader perspective of what the impacts are of the industry and how that should be addressed. And I think we're going to be coming to that point, because things are just going to get worse and worse, and so we won't be able to avoid it. And you've also made some comment about of the experience with foreign-owned mines.
Yes.
There's one that's not so far from where you live, owned by Hong Kong.
Yes. So this is another problem which, you know, we seem to have not addressed. You know, you just shake your head and wonder, you know, why how we are so it's just like we almost have a blindfold. We want to have this economic development in our province, right? Right now, for example, with the current government, we've announced that we're going to really push the critical minerals strategy in Manitoba. Well, we have to be so careful how we do this, because these resources are not renewable, right? Once they're gone, they're gone. But it's not just the resources that are gone, it's also the environmental impacts that you are left with forever after. And so on the one hand, yes, we tout these projects that, you know, we should accept them because they bring in great jobs and money for us. But on the other hand, right, what we've experienced, like not just in Manitoba, but other places in Canada, is that many of these mines get bought up by foreign interests that are not even on this continent, especially China. But we've also had, you know, like, for example, at Flin Flon, we had routes that used to stretch, because that's not like what it was, but it used to stretch all the way to South Africa. We have many, many examples like this. We have a mine that was a very important mine in eastern Manitoba that mined tantalum and now cesium. It's owned by a Hong Kong company now. And so things like this, you know, where that really dilutes the economic benefit that we get from, you know, doing this in the first place. So yes, there will be jobs because locals are still hired to do the jobs, but the product and the profit gets shipped offshore, right? So we don't really benefit much from that other than whatever licenses and fees and things the companies have to pay. And then when the company's done, it walks away. And a lot of the time, like, we're left with, you know, what do we do now? We no longer have that resource. It didn't benefit us as much as we thought it would. And we haven't thought of that ahead of time. Like, how, like we should have a much, much stricter review of, you know, the ownership and changes in ownership of these outfits, because these resources belong to us. They are our resources, and we should not be giving them away to somebody else, and we're not getting, you know, the benefit from that.
Do you have any questions, John?
Not at this moment, no.
Okay. Well, we could... talk about, before we have a musical break, what solutions would you propose, and how should our governments move forward on these issues? I think when it comes down to it, governments are very vulnerable to aspects of greed when it comes to exploiting our natural resources, and that an informed public has a very important role to play. And so, you know, we tend to blame the governments for making these decisions, but I guess it's a time for the public as well to have a very important role in all these decisions. Do you want to comment on that aspect?
Yes.
The solutions.
Yes, this is a multi-part solution that we would have to implement that would involve a lot of different aspects of our social and political system, right? So, first of all, like the politicians that we elect, right? In many cases, they are investors or owners of some of these projects that they are promoting once they got elected, and they are the ones that are influencing the legislation. And so instead of relaxing the legislation to make it, you know, easier, we have to have much, well, we do have some conflict of interest legislation, but we have to be much more diligent in terms of all levels, municipal, provincial, federal levels, where we cannot, you know, have somebody who has an agenda of their own, and they're also involved in promoting a certain project. We need to have informed government decisions, because like the ministers that are in charge of portfolios, right, in a lot of cases, they have no background or experience in the area that they're supposed to be overseeing. And in many cases, they have, like in Manitoba, for example, ministers have the final overriding power to veto or approve a project, regardless of all the deliberations that have gone on before them. And this is a very, I think, a very dangerous slope for us, because it comes down eventually to one person who makes the final decision, and that person might not be versed at all in that area and understand what the impacts of their decision are going to be. Hey, you mentioned correctly that the public is of paramount importance, because the public are the ones who should be, you know, at the hearings and writing submissions and appearing to make presentations to show the government what, you know, what we want, because the government is very limited and often slanted and biased in terms of how they want things to eventually go and be approved. And so this is the public's job to show what we want, because this impacts us in the end. The politicians are going to be long gone, right? They might retire to their Florida houses or whatever, right? They're no longer involved. We and all our descendants are the ones that are going to have to live with these the results of these decisions that they made. And then education is extremely important. Like, not only does the public need to be aware, right, of the environment and how it is suffering and what we need to do, because the public needs to be aware in order to be able to participate. So we need education, not just for the public, but also in our schools. We have to have a solid environmental grounding for students from an early age, so that they are aware and grow and mature into responsible, concerned citizens who see the value of the environment and not just the dollar value of things. Because the way we function is, wait, if something doesn't have dollar value, that means it's worthless, and we don't need it. We don't consider all of these other important things. Like, this is our life support system, for Pete's sakes, and we are ruining it more and more every single day. And what is going to happen in the future? Like, if we just lose more and more and more of it, and even our water, right, it becomes contaminated more and more and more as we go along. And so people have to be aware of this, and people have to speak out on behalf of the environment, because the industries aren't going to do that. And the government seems very reluctant to do that, because the government is concerned about getting votes, right, for the next election. So if they say something that's unpopular with industry, or, you know, even the politicians themselves, it might be adverse to their own portfolios and so on. And so, you know, you need the public to be that force that really provides the guidance here, because the way we have the system now, right, that there, we don't have enough protections, and we don't have, we certainly don't have enough people that are speaking out about this.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, I think education, that should be a very important part of the curriculum, is understanding environmental issues, and to have a public that is aware and that can speak to these issues. And at this point, Eva, I'll do a station ID, and I was wondering, did you have a song that you would, I think, John, you have a song, right, that...
Yeah,
that we could play.
Actually, she had sent a song request from, I believe, something that she wrote. But the problem is that I don't have access to that, so I would have to, I don't have access, so I would have to, if you have a different song request, I could play that.
How about, do you have it? I keep thinking of Beethoven. I don't know why.
Because I compose music. I compose piano music. And so I had put out a CD, an album of some of my compositions. And so I had sent you, John, a link to one of the tracks on that CD.
Yeah, like, I tried opening it, but then, like, I don't know, I enter in my email address, and then it doesn't work. It says I don't have access, so.
Oh. Okay, well, that's the first I've heard of that.
I'm going to do station ID. This is CQW 95.9 FM. We're speaking to Eva Pip as our guest. My name is Mary Jane Eason with John Dick. Perhaps we could just play any song at all that seems to could we have some classical song?
I could put on some Beethoven if
Are you okay with that, Eva?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go. We'll have a song anyway.
This is Moonlight Sonata.
Oh, that's a nice one.
Thank you.
Okay. That was Beethoven, Moonlight Sonata, beautiful piece. Eva, would you be able to join us again next week? Because they have still more things to talk about.
Oh, actually, she's off right now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I'll have to... okay. Well, we'll just... I have a few announcements to make, and I'll be calling Eva after this program to ask her to continue our conversation. I have an announcement from Peace Alliance Winnipeg. The announcement says Canada is still arming genocide. The date is November the 16th at noon in front of the CBC Manitoba. That's right, 541 Portage Avenue. This action is being taken in coordination with actions across Canada, led by World Beyond War Canada. Despite the winds, the Arms Embargo Now campaign has had, and despite Jolie's and Trudeau's frequent claims to have ended the export of Canadian weapons to Israel, the flow of arms has not stopped. On September 10, 2024, Minister Jolie said, "We will not have any form of arms or parts of arms be sent to Gaza, period. This is a lie. Canadian weapons are continuing to be sent to Israel and continue to be used in Gaza and Lebanon. And here's what the Canadian government has done." This is from Peace Alliance Winnipeg. This is what the Canadian government has done: paused issuing new permits for weapons exports to Israel. They suspended 30, or roughly 12% of the 200 plus permits that had already been issued. These active permits are for military goods that are continuing to be shipped out to Israel right now. The next point, they promised to stop one planned shipment of Canadian-made explosives to Israel through the U.S., but only after details of this one shipment was revealed by Fluke and provoked U.S. This one shipment among hundreds were revealed by Fluke and provoked huge public outcry. Here's what the Canadian government has not done. They haven't suspended or canceled 88% of the permits currently being used to ship arms to Israel. Secondly, they haven't done anything to stop the vast majority of arms exports to Israel, which don't even need an export permit because they use a loophole that allows military goods to go to Israel via the U.S., unreported and unregulated. And thirdly, they haven't stopped importing weapons from Israel. Canada continues to fund the Israeli war machine by purchasing Israeli weapons for the Canadian military, marketed for the Canadian military. Marketed as battle tested on Palestinians. So Canada continues to fund the Israel war machine by purchasing Israeli weapons for the Canadian military, marketed as battle tested on Palestinians. Suspending just 12% of active permits to Israel is not enough. Letting Canadian weapons flow to Israel via the U.S., untracked and without requiring permit, is unacceptable. So we are asked to join Peace Alliance Winnipeg at their protest on Saturday, that's November the 6th at noon, at the CBC, which is at 541 Portage Avenue. I now have some... while we have a bit of time here, I have some vegan-type recipes that people might be interested in for people that may not like to use or cannot use eggs or are allergic to eggs, or they are vegans. So you can make your own eggs out of flax seeds. You can take 1/3 cup of whole flax seeds. It could be golden or brown. and 1 cup of water. And in a blender, you process, you blend the seeds. First of all, you in a blender, you process the seeds to an even meal and slowly add the water while blending. Blend until the mixture resembles a thick milkshake, and then transfer to a container and store in the refrigerator for, it'll keep for 3 to 6 days. And this is equivalent to 6 eggs. So you have to keep the lid on tight so that it stays fresh. And you could take 2 tablespoons, I would say, to make an egg, something to that effect. I don't recall. Usually the recipes might tell you how much to put in, but 2 tablespoons of flax eggs would be, 2 tablespoons of a flax meal like that with water would be about an egg, I would think. And here's another recipe to make a faux sour cream. You need 2 cups of soft or medium tofu and 1/4 cup of oil and 3 tablespoons of lemon juice or vinegar and 1 teaspoon of sweetener of your choice. It could be brown sugar or honey and different whatever sugars you have or maple syrup. And 1 tablespoon of Bragg's or soy sauce. Bragg's is a special condiment that's often used by vegans. And soy sauce, to choose soy sauce, don't get the soy sauce that's the chemical soy sauce. Get one that is a good quality one that is actually made from fermented soy, so it's not made artificially. There's a number of brands available that are like that. So those are some of the recipes, and I have one recipe to make classic ketchup. So you can take 1 6-ounce can of tomato paste, 1.5 tablespoons of vinegar, and 1 tablespoon of sweetener. It could be sugar or whatever, or maple syrup, whatever. 1 teaspoon of Bragg's or soy sauce, and 1/8 teaspoon of dried basil, and 1/8 teaspoon of paprika, 1/8 teaspoon of salt, and 2.5 tablespoons of water. So probably you don't have 1/8 teaspoon. If you have 1/4 teaspoon, you just take 1/4 of a quarter. And so in a medium saucepan, simmer all the ingredients on medium-low heat for about 10 to 15 minutes, stirring often, and set aside to cool and store in the refrigerator. So you can have your own ketchup, which is reportedly a lot better than the one you buy. And you should have it in a tight-fitting lid so that it will keep its flavor, and it will last in the refrigerator for about 2 weeks. And those are the few condiments that you can make to season your food. And I think this ends our program for today for Wooden Spoons. I'm hoping that we can continue our discussion with Eva Pip next week.
You've been listening to Wooden Spoons, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM. For our podcast, please go to ckw.ca, type Wooden Spoons into the search bar, and the program will be up in just a few hours. Until next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.